From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Iran directly attacked Israel for the first time over the weekend, launching some 300 cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and drones at the Jewish state. Israel intercepted most of them with the help of the United States, the UK, Jordan, and perhaps other countries, and they did little damage. But the attack nonetheless crossed a new line of escalation in the war between Israel and Iran that until now has been fought via Iran's proxy armies. How will Israel respond to the attack, especially since the White House has advertised far and wide that President Biden wants Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government to calm down and not strike back at Iran? To discuss these and other questions, my guest today is Mark Dubowitz, CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, an invaluable think tank, who has recently returned to the U.S. from Israel. Welcome, Mark. Good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Paul. Thank you.
So let's talk first about the nature of this Iranian attack and how it was intercepted for the most part. Some folks, analysts, are even saying that the fact that Iran telegraphed its attack, or at least seemed to, means that it somehow wanted it to fail while sending a message that worse could happen if somehow Israel responded. Do you buy any of that?
No, I think that's ridiculous. I think the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, launches over 300 cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and drones because he wants to kill Israelis. Now, he telegraphs that through the Turks. The Turks warn the Americans warn the Israelis. I think the Supreme Leader was probably surprised by the technological wizardry on display by Israel's air defense systems in partnership with the United States and other allies. But he also wanted to send a message that this time around, those have conventional warheads. Next time around, they may have nuclear and chemical warheads. So that was much as a warning as it was an attempt to hurt Israelis.
Do you agree with the analysis at this point? I do agree with this, that the launch demonstrates that the Iranian government is willing to take new risks, that it's willing to escalate, crossing this threshold of a direct attack, which it has never done before. And that suggests that it doesn't really fear a response.
Well, I think it doesn't fear a response from the United States. And so that's the key. I mean, President Biden said right before this attack, when asked what the Iranians should do, he said, don't. And the Iranians did. And so Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei has Biden's number. He understands that the United States today is not willing to use American power against the Islamic Republic, even to stop the nuclear weapons program that is galloping ahead. He also understands that the likely reaction of President Biden to the Iranian attack and any kind of discussion of Israeli reprisal will also be don't, but this time don't to the Israelis. Don't respond. And sure enough, Khamenei got that exactly right, because we're hearing President Biden has told Netanyahu to stand down. And so I think he perceives fecklessness from the Biden administration. He's testing that, and he's realizing that at the end of the day, Israel will stand alone in dealing with the threat from the Islamic Republic. And he wants to make it very clear that I can hit you not only through my proxies, as I've done repeatedly for 40 years, but I can deliver a serious punch from Iranian soil using the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East.
Why do you think it was willing to cross that line now?
I think for a few reasons. First of all, the Israelis took out this IRGC general, Mohammad Reza Zayidi, in Damascus, and killed him and his deputy and five other IRGC commanders. Zahidi was a big fish.
Right.
I mean, people don't know him. They should. He was probably the most battle-hardened, experienced IRGC commander that the Iranians have today. I mean, he was probably after Qasem Soleimani, who the Trump administration killed, along with support from Mossad. He is the most experienced and one of the most deadly battlefield commanders in the battle space. And so when the Israeli Air Force took him out in Damascus in a really a daring operation with exquisite intelligence, that was a blow and a shock to the regime. And so they felt that they had to respond. Normally, they would respond through proxies. I think that was probably Israeli military intelligence assessment that was given to the War Cabinet. I think the Israelis were also surprised that Khamenei was willing to direct this from Iranian soil. But I think he's willing to escalate and send a message. Look, if you go after my top commanders or you come after my nuclear weapons program, you're not only going to contend with Hezbollah or Hamas or my other Shiite militias, you're going to contend with me.
Very interesting. Now, one of the things that Israel has long been concerned about is an attack from Lebanon by Hezbollah or from Syria, or both combined, in addition to an attack from Iran. And yet, in this case, the Hezbollah has been reasonably restrained. It's had some symbolic missile launches against north of Israel, but it really hasn't launched the tens of thousands of rockets and missiles that it has, Hezbollah has. Are you surprised by that?
Well, look, I think Iran and Hezbollah have actually accomplished a pretty significant win in that they've cleared out all of northern Israel. I mean, there are 60,000 Israelis who are not in their homes. The north of Israel is today a ghost town. It's essentially a military zone. And they've been able to do that daily, you know, and it's daily firing missiles and anti-tank missiles at Israeli towns and cities. They've killed Israeli civilians, Israeli soldiers, not in great numbers, but enough that it's for Israeli civilians who saw October 7th and what happened with Hamas, they've gotten out of Dodge. I mean, they've been cleared from their towns. And so that's quite a victory. I think Khamenei is saving Hezbollah. He didn't want to unleash Hezbollah after the killing of the IRGC commander, because I think that that would lead to a major war between Israel and Hezbollah. And I think he doesn't want to see Hezbollah go the same way as Hamas has, sustaining such huge battlefield casualties. He's saving Hezbollah for a serious reprisal, and that could be if Israel decides to go after Iran's nuclear weapons program.
So there is an implicit threat that continues from Hezbollah that if there is a response from Israel, somehow the Khamenei could unleash them again into a much more comprehensive assault. I guess that is part of the implicit threat that continues to exist.
Yes, well, it's an explicit threat because it's being demonstrated every day on the northern border today.
Right. But I'm talking about in the tens of thousands of missiles.
Sure, sure. No, an implicit threat that, again, and the Israelis have been, you know, planning against this for years. This is always a bit of a deterrence by punishment that the supreme leader has conveyed, which is if you go after my nuclear program or you go after leadership assets, then I will unleash Hezbollah on you, and then 150,000-170,000 rockets will be raining down on Israeli towns, including hundreds of precision-guided munitions capable of perhaps evading Israeli air defenses and taking out civilian infrastructure, strategic sites, military sites. So it's been a formidable threat, and the Israelis are going to have to respond to it. I mean, they're going to have to deal with it by denying that threat, which is by bolstering their air defenses, and part of that is cooperating with the United States and Arab countries. But part of that is also reestablishing deterrence by punishment. You know, deterrence by denial, Paul, spectacularly failed on October 7th with Hamas.
Right.
The idea that we will deter by denial, that if you fire missiles and rockets or send terrorists over the border, we will do our best to defend that with technological walls and air defense systems. Well, that's failed spectacularly on October 7th. That, by the way, deterrence by denial is the governing philosophy of the Biden administration. It's what the Biden administration is trying to convince Israel to do, which is to deny the Iranians the ability to harm their civilians. And this weekend is being used as sort of exhibit A, or President Biden called it a win, for deterrence by denial. Well, deterrence by denial doesn't work in the tough neighborhood of the Middle East, where any kind of weakness is seen as a provocation.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the American calls for restraint on the Israeli government when we come back.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Mark Dubowitz, the CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. The U.S. is broadcasting through leaks that its military help was crucial to the successful defense against the Iranian missile assault, in rather remarkable detail about interventions of jets and from destroyer missiles. And it's also leaking what Biden told Benjamin Netanyahu, which is including the phrase, quote, take the win, unquote. quote, the win being the fact that nearly all of the missiles and drones were intercepted. The administration doesn't make those kinds of leaks if it's not really trying to send a message. And then you had the G7 statement, which also counseled de-escalation. This really poses a dilemma for Netanyahu and his government, it seems to me. Can he afford to ignore these warnings?
I think the Israelis have this, they have actually have a unique problem of any democracy on earth, and that is they exist in a split screen, right? On one end, they're a Western democracy. They're part of the, you know, Western liberal order for whatever that's worth anymore. And they have to be concerned about their partnership with the United States. They have to be concerned about their reputation. They obviously have to be concerned about using proportionate force and making sure that they limit civilian casualties when they go in and fight these hardened enemies. The other side of the split screen is they live in the Middle East, a tough neighborhood, where, as I said, any sign of weakness is a provocation. And there they have to actually use disproportionate force in order to ensure that their enemies understand that if they try to harm Israelis, that they will face 10 times, 100 times the response. And obviously, when they exist in that space and they're trying to send a message to their enemies in the Middle East, they're open to huge criticism from the Biden administration, from Democratic members of Congress, and from the media that wants them to basically operate as if they don't live in the Mideast, but they live in the Midwest.
Yeah, we're worried about that missile barrage from Toronto.
Right, exactly. As if, you know, as if they live in a neighborhood where Justin Trudeau, not Ali Khamenei, is their most formidable enemy. This is a dilemma for any Israeli prime minister. Now, Israeli prime ministers in the past, Paul, as you know only too well, you've covered it for many years. I mean, they've defied American dictates, right?
Sure.
Menachem Begin stared down Ronald Reagan, of all people, and launched a daring operation in 1981 to destroy Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program. Ehud Olmert defied George W. Bush, of all people, and launched a daring operation to destroy Syria's nuclear weapons program. And there are many other examples where the Israelis have said, hey, America, thanks for your advice. Appreciate the guidance. At the end of the day, we have a responsibility to protect our people and have gone and done what they've had to do. So I would expect the Israeli government will respond. There will be a retaliation. It may be a dish best served cold. It may not come immediately, but it's going to come and has to send a message to Ali Khamenei that he can't send hundreds of cruise and ballistic missiles into Israeli cities, because if that becomes a new normal, Israel is in an even more serious security predicament.
And yet there is the implication of the American backslapping of this defensive effort that, hey, you couldn't have done it, Israel, without us, right? We helped you so much. Jordan helped you. We helped organize the interceptions of these missiles. And while there's, you know, the president says, look, our support for Israel is ironclad, there's also this kind of just background sense that, you know what, if you defy us and create a bigger war, I don't know, we won't like this. And they're not saying explicitly, we won't support you, but it lurks in the background, I think, as a low-level warning. That's at least how I read it.
I read it exactly the same way. I mean, there's an implicit threat. And as I said, the implicit threat is don't.
Right.
Right. It's don't to the Israelis. I mean, I just had a Biden administration official once tell me that leverage is something to be used against allies, not against adversaries. The sort of sense that, you know, we Americans have a lot of leverage. We're going to use that leverage against our allies because they're going to have to listen to us. Whereas, you know, our adversaries, we're afraid that if we use leverage, they'll escalate against us and we'll be involved in a confrontation. I think that is very much the governing philosophy of the Biden administration. I think the governing philosophy of the Biden administration is also that using American power will only get the Iranians mad and they'll escalate. If they escalate, we'll again be in a regional confrontation. And so we mustn't use American power. We must use diplomacy. And diplomacy consists of providing tens of billions of dollars in sanctions relief to the Iranians to get them to stand down. I mean, it's a completely different philosophy about power and deterrence, and it's completely at odds with the way the Israelis think about it, which is why we always run into these situations with our Israeli friends, where they kind of take a look at us and think, what world do you live in? Because it doesn't look like the world we live in.
So you think Netanyahu and the government will respond somehow directly, and you think this will be on Iranian territory? And I guess the question that goes with that is the political one in Israel. Can Netanyahu not afford to respond to this attack on Israeli soil and civilians? Because these missiles were not targeted. They were indiscriminate. They were going to land all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know about the targeting. I mean, I think they're fairly targeted. I mean, they were going after certain strategic sites, military sites. But then again, there were also a number that were indiscriminate. In fact, there was a 7-year-old Bedouin Arab girl who was struck in the head, who's in a severe condition and is in hospital. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, a lot of the media and a lot of people have ignored her plight. There could have been a lot more Israeli kids in hospital or, God forbid, worse if those air defenses haven't worked. So, yeah, Netanyahu is under tremendous political pressure from the Israeli public to act. I think he believes philosophically and practically that he needs to act in order to reestablish deterrence by punishment. But again, it'll be at a time of his choosing, and we'll see. My personal view is if you're going to act and you're going to take the blame from the Biden administration, you got to go after the most serious threat to the state of Israel today, which is Iran's rapidly expanding nuclear weapons program, which we haven't talked about today, but they are poised to cross certain red lines that are going to make it very difficult for Israel or even the United States to act in the future. And so if you're going to take the political hit, you know, go after weapons scientists, go after the new site that's being built in Natanz that's going 100 meters underground, encased in concrete under a mountain that, you know, if when it's done in 2 years' time, will be impervious to Israeli and even American bombs. So if you're going to do it, make it count.
Well, that's an interesting counsel. And John Bolton, the former U.S. National Security Advisor, agrees with you. But it's very clear from the messages coming from the White House that President Biden wouldn't support that. And that what you just described, going after the nuclear sites, is really the most ambitious military project that Israel could undertake right now, right? These sites are buried deep underground. They're heavily defended with air defenses. Now, Israel would have the capacity to take out those air defenses, I assume, but there's a long way to fly to get there. And for Israel to do it alone would be undertaking a major risk. I'm inclined to agree with you that they probably should do that if they're going to take the risk, but it's a very, very big deal.
Yeah, Paul, you're right. Though I have to say, first of all, there's now evidence that Iran has begun its weaponization activities. It's been the longstanding view of the U.S. intelligence community. The National Intelligence Estimate 2007 says Iran has not restarted its weaponization activities since 2003. What I mean by weaponization is the building of the nuclear warhead, the final thing Iran has to do to have a deliverable nuclear weapon. Well, I believe, based on conversations that I've had, that they've begun preliminary work on those weaponization activities. And there's really only a few dozen, maybe less, weapon scientists in Iran that have the capability of building that warhead. So if I were an Israeli prime minister, I'd be instructing Mossad and the IDF to be planning operations to take out Iranian nuclear weapon scientists. You don't need F-35s flying. You don't need a huge Israeli air force or ground presence. You know, you need a very well planned, maybe perfectly executed covert operation to kill as many weapon scientists as possible, maybe recruit a few and maybe terrify the rest in order to delay the weaponization efforts. I think with respect to this new site that's being built, again, I think there are ways to, I don't really want to talk about it publicly, but there are ways to disable that site and they don't require Air Force bombings or F-35s and dropping of massive ordnance penetrators quite yet. You can disable sites in a variety of creative ways. Those are things that can be done with a small footprint covertly and don't necessarily even have to be attributed to Israel. So there are things that can be done and should be done and need to be done in order to roll back Iran's expanding nuclear weapons program.
And of course, other suggestions have been to take out Iranian air defenses, for example, take out some of the production facilities for drones, also go after their oil and gas operations, which supply money for the regime. I suppose all of those are on a potential target list.
Absolutely, Paul. I mean, you know, one should remember that Mossad has actually gone after Iran's drone program. They took out a whole fleet of drones really literally on the runway a couple of years ago in a really daring operation. Mossad has, you know, gone after nuclear weapons scientists, IRGC commanders, drone facilities, missile commanders inside Iran. Israel's got a long-standing record of quite successful covert operations, certainly going after refineries, pipelines, ports. I mean, again, Israel is not a military superpower, but it is a cyber superpower. And Israel's Unit 8200, which is their equivalent of our NSA, has formidable offensive cyber power. and has used that in the past in quite effective ways. So the prime minister has a variety of options that he can choose from. The only question really is not so much of one of Israeli capabilities or Israeli will. It's about American will and whether he can withstand the overwhelming pressure from President Biden to stand down and take the win that really wasn't a win.
And we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the administration's view of the Israeli operation in Hamas and whether or not this gives Israel more running room politically as it tries to destroy Hamas in Gaza when we come back.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back again. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal Potomac Watch podcast here with Mark Dubowitz, CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. I want to ask you before we go about the U.S. policy on Iran, because you alluded to this earlier, but there's no question in my mind that what we have seen is the failure of the U.S. And the Biden administration's Iran policy. It sought to engage the regime in renegotiating the nuclear deal. Iran has shown no interest in that. It sought to somehow appease Iran by refusing to enforce the sanctions on oil and easing other sanctions, giving Iran access to tens of billions of dollars in frozen funds. And that seems not to have changed Iranian behavior for the better at all. In fact, if anything, it has seemed to have encouraged the Iranians to unleash their proxies, going after not only Israel, but also U.S. forces in Iraq and in Syria, and of course, to go a long way to shutting down commerce in the Red Sea. Do you think this latest attack by Iran on Israel is going to change the Biden administration's policy towards Iran to a tougher one, which would, I think, require marshaling a coalition again to isolate Iran and punish it and reduce its financing and put a lot of other pressure on Iran?
Paul, I think about this. I think I'm right. You and I are both men of faith, right? We believe in God.
Sure.
And so I'm sure you've had discussions over the years with friends who are atheists, and you spend hours discussing the existence of God, and you amass evidence that God exists, and they amass evidence that God doesn't exist, and you walk away in violent disagreement, and no one's changing anyone's mind. Well, those are exactly the conversations that I have with senior Biden administration officials about the wisdom of using American power against the supreme leader of Iran, and that he will back down in the face of American power. Well, they say no, he will escalate in the face of American power. And we spend a couple hours, I bring my evidence, they bring their evidence, and we walk away in violent disagreement. I see no evidence that the Biden administration, which again, is very much the Obama administration. I mean, it's
right. Very, very much.
Right. You know, that's the same people, it's the same policies, it's the same discussions that we had under Obama. They don't believe in the exercise of American power. They believe that American power will lead the supreme leader of Iran to escalate. It'll lead to a regional war. The regional war will spike oil prices ahead of November. And it'll lead to a conflagration that the Biden administration wants to avoid at all costs. Well, we all want to avoid that at all costs. But I think the evidence of the Islamic Republic's history is that when they face American power, they back down. When they sense American weakness, they push forward. And right now they have, I think Khamenei has Biden's number. He sees an American president who is feckless, is not willing to use power, is happy to play defense and brag about taking a win when you have a defensive win like we did on the weekend, but is absolutely not committed to using American power in any significant way against the Islamic Republic, even when the Islamic Republic kills Americans as they have many times before, including under the Biden administration, including recently when they killed three American soldiers in Jordan, and the Biden administration responded not by going after Iran, not by going after the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, but by telegraphing that IRGC commanders should get out of Dodge, and then they dropped some bombs on some, you know, hapless militias who happened to be standing there or who decided not to take that warning. So I think there's a philosophical difference, and this is why they are always at odds with Israeli prime ministers who believe the exact opposite. They're men of faith in Israel, and they're also men of faith in the wisdom of power and deterrence by punishment, not deterrence by denial.
How does the attack on the weekend change the ability and the running room for Israel when it comes to finishing the job against Hamas in Gaza, and particularly going into the city of Rafah, the last stronghold of Hamas? Do you think it has any more running room?
It depends. Depends on how it acts. You know, I think I've been pretty negative about the weekend and whether this was a win or a loss for Israel or a win for the Biden administration. I think it's a win for Israel in this respect. I mean, for months now, the focus has been on Israel, focus on Gaza, Hamas, Rafah, civilian casualties. You know, the Biden administration, for the president, the vice president, Democratic members of Congress, the Europeans, the media, you name it, everybody has been beaten up on Israel. And the focus has been on Israel and Hamas. I think it's been good to focus out. And now everybody understands that the head of the snake, or the head of the octopus, as it were, is the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that Israel's been fighting its tentacles, and that Israel now needs to direct its fire, or at least the world needs to direct its attention on the head of the octopus, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran. So yeah, Israel should take that win, spend some time, keep the Iranians in the penalty box where they belong. But at some point, they're going to have to go into Rafah. At some point, everybody's going to get refocused on Gaza, because they can't let 4-6 Hamas battalions stay in that territory. And they can't let Gawar Sinwar declare a victory. So it'll get back to where we were before. And then the Biden administration will be beating up on Israel, and we'll be back to status quo ante. But for now, it's good that the focus is on the Islamic Republic of Iran. Paul, I'll say one other thing. I mean, after October 7th, you know this, right? The Biden administration was scrambling to disconnect the dots and move the attention away from Iran, even claiming that Iran was not involved in the planning or financing or execution of October 7th.
Right, right. Remember that.
Remember that, right? Well, the dots have been reconnected, not by the Biden administration and its policies or its strategic communications efforts, but by the fact that Ali Khamenei has reminded the world that he is indeed the head of the octopus. Those tentacles that Israel's been fighting in Gaza and Lebanon are his. You know, for now, at least we all appreciate, for now, it'll probably be fleeting, that the real enemy of the United States and of democracies is the Islamic Republic of Iran.
All right. I think we shall leave it at that for today. It's really a dangerous period in the Middle East. We'll see how the Israelis respond, and whether or not the U.S. is actually going to support Israel in its self-defense against a terrible national menace in Iran. And I sure appreciate your being here, Mark. Appreciate your work. Mark Dubowitz, CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Always instructive. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Potomac Watch. We're here every day with the Wall Street Journal Opinion Pages podcast. Thanks for listening.